Hello, sports fans, and welcome to this week's edition of the UConn Pod. I'm on Kidwai, manager of the UConn blog, here with Brenner Pizak, who is our sound editor slash football analyst, and also Tim Fontenot. What's up, guys?
What's up, Amon? Glad to be here.
Hello, Amon. Hello, Brenner. Hello, UConn fans. Good to be here.
We've got a chock full schedule of wonderful UConn-related things to talk about, but first, we do have some disappointing news in UConn country. A UConn Husky student, inebriated, made his way over to the student union, entered a...
What the hell was that?
Got into an extended something, an extended conflict, if you will.
Good timing.
To use an appropriate theme for the week. Got into a conflict with the manager at the student union. He really wanted mac and cheese, jalapeno bacon mac and cheese. That does sound good.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of jalapenos, but the union mac and cheese is up there among the all-time greats.
It's top level.
Yeah, I can understand wanting desperately to have the mac and cheese there, but come on. The kid walks in, from what we understand, with an open 40. So, strike one. He's 19, strike two. And apparently this is a kid who is new to UConn. He got kicked out of UMass for two drunken altercations in the span of a week. So here he is. I think he's just some UMass infiltrator trying to learn the ice bus's secrets, and he just decided to go ahead and be a jerk in the middle of the union and mess with some fine, hardworking employees who want to give other kids who deserve it the delicious mac and cheese.
Really fine, hardworking employees, and then obviously sullying the reputation of the students because, of course, Deadspin and it's the like are very quick to put this up on the internet, make fun of it, probably making comments about how classy or not our student body is. People from Boston College probably calling us new money for having good mac and cheese in our student union now.
We've always had it.
I thought it was interesting.
I've been having that mac and cheese since I was a freshman, like 20 years ago.
It's been a staple.
Yeah.
Anyway, not the greatest news to kick off our UConn our week as Husky fans, but on the plus side, we have a lot of good stuff in store, including, of course, the fact that we have the big rivalry matchup in football this weekend against UCF. The conflict will kick off at 3:45 this Saturday. We're going to break down the BYU game a little bit today. Talk about what exactly all went wrong. Tim and I just got out of Bob Diaco's press conference, so got a couple of tidbits from there to discuss for sure. The ice bus started rolling this past Saturday. We'll talk about that as well. And two UConn commitments clashed against each other this past Friday in a really, really exciting Connecticut high school football game. So we've got a lot to get through, Tim, but why don't we start with the field hockey team, which has been absolutely dominating people so far this year.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, what is it now? They've outscored teams 38-0 over the last three games, something like that. Yeah, like 10-0, 10-0, and 8-0 are their last three games. They just beat Yale on Sunday after wins over Villanova and Cal. It's ridiculous. I mean, this is, like we said the other day, UConn women's basketball meets UConn field hockey, and they're just dominating everybody. Looking at their schedule, they've given up 1, 2, 3. They've given up 5 goals in 11 games.
What is Rob Nichols 5 playing for them?
Yeah, right? I mean, it's absolutely absurd. They've given up 5 goals. They've scored 72. They're averaging 6.55 goals a game. I'm blown away by them, especially this girl, Charlotte Vetner, the German girl that we mentioned last week. I was looking up her career stats. You know, she's only a sophomore. She's already got 41 goals, 19 assists for 101 points. 41 goals puts her in a tie for 16th all-time.
All-time so, NCAA?
At UConn.
All-time UConn.
But, I mean, you know, UConn is one of the class programs in women's field hockey history. But the all-time goals record is 97. So you figure she's already halfway through her sophomore year. She's got 41 goals. I mean,
that's a lot, yeah.
She's going to be pushing 100 by the time everything's said and done. So good for her. Good for Nancy Stevens. We got to get to a game at some point and check them out, give them some press, because like I said, they don't get enough credit. They've won 2 straight national titles. They're dominating everybody. They deserve to be getting some respect and media attention.
Yeah, absolutely. They were down in New Haven. I was about 30 minutes away on Sunday. I probably should have gone, I guess, that entire day spent on my couch watching football. Maybe could have been spent better.
And we need that hashtag content.
Well, with a sophomore potentially breaking the all-time UConn scoring record, do we have to worry about Vitner going pro?
I mean, is there a professional field hockey league? I'm not too familiar with this. I know they now have indoor lacrosse. They have indoor field hockey. Could get intense.
I guess they don't. I guess there's no pro field hockey. There still are barriers that need to be broken in professional sports. Yeah. But
Nancy's going to have to watch out for her, though. I think Nancy coaches the USA team sometimes, and you know Charlotte's going to be coming up with that German team and just looking to mess things up. What is it, next year probably a Rio? She could make that team, I'm sure.
So definitely everyone try and make it out to a field hockey game. It's a really, really good team out there. I was at basketball media availability on Saturday this past weekend, and we just happened to be waiting for the team right where we could see the UConn field hockey game in progress against Villanova. When we got in there, in the waiting area, it was 5-0, and about 40 minutes later, it was 10-0. Just goal, goal, goal.
They do that a lot.
It was like West Virginia all over again.
Ugh.
But, Tim, why don't you give us the update in the world of UConn soccer?
Do I have to?
You do.
The UConn men's soccer team, it's been streaky, very, very streaky, to say the least. They started off with 3 straight draws. Things started to get better. They got 3 straight wins. Now they're on 3 straight losses. Losses to Boston College on the road, USF on the road, then came home, had their game last week against last year's Final Four participant Providence, postponed because of rain. Probably not playing that one. Played Memphis on Saturday, lost 1-0 in overtime. Just, they're struggling to find goals. They've got 6 goals in 9 games right now. It's really a frustrating time for them. They're 0-2 in the conference. They're a team that doesn't lose in the conference. So for them to be 0-2, you know, Diaco was hailing UCF for losing 2 games so far in conference play in football in the 3 years that they've been here. You know, UConn lost once in conference last year, didn't lose at all the year before. So they're in that, now they've got 3 losses all time in the American. It's kind of a rough time. They're young, though. They're really young. They just lost Kyle Laren and Adria Besso and a couple other guys. They're going to be really good next year. Dylan Greenberg's close to healthy. There's talk that he could come back this year, recovering from that broken collarbone he suffered August 28th. They're going to get there. It's a tough spot right now. They got a big game Wednesday against Cincinnati. They're not home again for 10 days after that. They go to SMU and Louisville in the meantime. So it's going to be an interesting spot. But you know, at least things are looking good for the women's soccer team, though. Looking at that 10-2 record, they just knocked off Temple the other day. Actually, that was kind of a close, narrow game, one of those 1-0s. They've had a couple of those lately. They haven't won by more than a goal in almost an entire month. So it's been tricky. It's been tough, but they're climbing. They're number 18 in the nation now. And they get East Carolina on Thursday for one of those, you know, what many fans would like to call a non-conference game. So they just, if they keep rolling, they're going to be in a good spot.
Well, that's good. And I hear you told me, I think they're 18th in the country. Is that right?
Yep, they're number 18 now. And I believe USF is 24 as of today. So 2 teams in the conference in that top 25, and UConn the highest of them.
Nice. All right, well, we're going to move on now and look back to the BYU game. UConn lost 30-13, which, you know, if you were out and about on a Friday night and maybe didn't catch the game, or your, you know, better sensibilities had you in bed at a reasonable time, maybe you didn't catch the end. And maybe you fell asleep when UConn was very much in this game. They had it tied 10-10 after the third quarter. Going into that fourth quarter, had a couple of stops, you know, had some chances to get ahead early on, and then things just completely fell apart. The Huskies gave up, I think, 20 points in that final fourth quarter.
Yeah, I would say the final score was certainly not indicative of the entire game.
Yeah, not at all. That was just things getting away from them in the fourth quarter, really nothing they could do about it after the Sheriff's interception, which I do want to touch on.
Yeah, definitely. So, Brenner, why don't we talk? We'll go to you first. What were some of the things that stood out to you from Friday night's BYU game?
Well, first off, I was impressed. I was impressed with, on defense, how we were able to, at least for the beginning of the game, we were able to get that pressure up in the middle. Fadakasi was a man the entire game. He was just a beast. On the field goal block, he was a beast. You saw him just, he was moving people all night. Even on the plays where they didn't get to him, he was getting pressure right up the middle, just moving his guy back 4 or 5 yards into the backfield. I was really, really impressed with his play. I thought there were some certainly questionable decisions, maybe I'll call them, on offense in the first half. I mean, we didn't complete a pass for quite some time into the game. On the first drive we had where we're moving the ball, it's 3rd and 3. We go for like a 30-yard pass attempt down the field. I didn't know if I loved that one since we looked to be moving the ball a little bit. Even though Newsom ran the ball on a couple nice plays, the one he did pop was already like stuffed in the middle. He made a nice individual play to break it outside and bounce it, but there wasn't a lot of room for him all night. I felt like the offensive line, once again, probably to be expected out there in BYU, had a bit of a tough time opening any holes and kind of getting that push that we needed. But I was impressed by the defense. I did want to see more press coverage, though. Thought that our guys on the outside could have at least been more physical at the outset with a lot of the receivers. They're tall, skinny, slender, quick guys, you know, and Michigan showed the week before that if you get physical with them at the line, you can disrupt a lot of the timing and you can really make it hard for them to get to the spot that they want to get to. So I thought that we were really given like eight to 10 yards. Javon Williams was playing way off his guys and almost kind of like we were playing that bend but don't break, you know, let's see if we can get a turnover, which is an understandable way to go. But I think towards crunch time, once the game got closer, I would have liked to see our guys press up on there and make their guys get physical to get open rather than just giving up those 7-8 yards, because at one point BYU was targeting Javon Williams on like 70% of the plays, no matter who was lining up against him. If it was a pass play, it was going at Javon Williams, and they knew he was playing off coverage. And I was charting at one point, like I said, 70% of the plays on offense were just going at him regardless of who they were running out there. So I think that when you're getting exploited like that, and we could see it for 3+ quarters, I would have liked to see a change, especially when the week before, I know that the commentators, the announcers had been mentioning it a little bit on the broadcast, but it did work the week before, and I would have liked to see just a little bit of switch in that, because I think that UConn's guys are talented enough to get up there and play that press coverage and play bump and run, and could hang with those guys rather than just giving the 6 to 8 yards pretty much at will.
Yeah, I mean, the press coverage, when they did try it those few times, it looked like it worked. But you're right, it's just 100%. Diaco has his philosophy defensively, and it's that bend but don't break, and he really doesn't want to stray away too much from that, it seems. You know, a lot of people were commenting just, you know, why not press those receivers? We saw Michigan do really well by pressing their receivers, by being physical with them. It's just not in our defensive philosophy, I guess. And
you could understand early on, you know, don't want to get behind early at BYU and then they pop a couple big plays right off the start. You want to stay in the game and look for a couple turnovers, which we got. And, you know, it looks to be working at that point. But then, like I said, and like you said, it did work when we tried it. At some time, maybe you got to employ it just to try to get that final play to get over the hump. Because I think really UConn was right there in this game.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's the defense, you know, the offense. The defense did really, really well until they started having to defend 90-plus plays, and that becomes a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the defense was playing kind of uncharacteristically. I think a word I would use to describe the way Diaco's approach this season is, you know, he wants his team to play, for lack of a better word, ballsy. And, you know, I feel like, you know, like Brenner said, they should have been playing more press coverage. I feel like if they were a little more aggressive, like you don't need to be up in the guy's face on every play, but just enough to make him uncomfortable. And I feel like BYU didn't feel any pressure whatsoever in the passing game. But I want to touch on Foley Fatakasi because Brenner brought this up. I thought he was fantastic. I think, you know, and he obviously had that first half against Army, I believe, where he was suspended, but he, to me, could be the defensive MVP. You know, you can make the case for Andrew Adams. I think that Fatakasi could be right there. You know, he's got, you know, he leads the team in tackles for loss. He's, you know, he's only got 14 tackles overall, but 4 tackles for loss. He has as many sacks at 3.5 as the rest of the team combined. So this is a guy who has really been a great source of energy on this D defensive line. He's been really bringing a lot of pressure. He wasn't really a named guy before this year, and he comes in and he's really starting to press the issue for the defense.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what else? He plays a position on the defense in that, you know, in Bob Diaco's 3-4 scheme that is really not supposed to rack up stats like that.
Right.
Which makes it that much more impressive, I think. You know, the 3-4 end is supposed to be a space eater, take up blockers, free up the linebackers to make plays, and Fatu Kasi's the one out there just destroying people. And I think, you know, that's a really good point, you know, about him with the defense, that, you know, he could definitely be the team's, you know, the most valuable player on what is a really good defense.
Yeah, it's so frustrating to watch. It hasn't been the case as significantly this year, but we always talk about one of the biggest problems for UConn is having a great defense and then the offense letting them down. That defense kept them in the game, all three quarters. Then you get into the fourth quarter and UConn's starting to get a drive going, starting to get a little momentum. You're like, they can really do this. They can go into BYU and win this game against a team that beat Boise State, beat Nebraska, really could have and should have beat UCLA, and then just completely whatever the Michigan game was. If Sheriffs had just gone down, if he had just taken the sack, that interception doesn't happen. Everything else after it doesn't happen. UConn's still in that game at that point. I think for a guy who's been as smart as he has all year, that was unbelievably stupid.
Yeah, you're right. It is really uncharacteristic from what we've seen of Sheriff so far, you know, just being such a smart player, being touted as a very smart player before we had a chance to see him play, him living up to that billing, you know, to see him make that kind of play, you know, or attempt as he's being pulled down is definitely disappointing. But, you know, that's one play, that's one opportunity. As a whole, the offense didn't really do a very good job, you know, at all.
I had an... To go along with that, I had a problem with three times during the game we're calling timeout to avoid a delay of game.
Yep, absolutely.
And I'm not sure where the breakdown in communication is, but it almost looks like he's not getting the play. Like, Sheriffs is waiting for the play in the huddle, asking for the play at like 16, 17 seconds on the play clock before he can even give it to his guys and get lined up. And, I mean, it was consistent throughout the game. We're behind the play clock, rushing. And like I said, to have three timeouts in an away game where you know that the team that you're playing is a talented team that's all charged up on a Friday night on ESPN, to use three timeouts throughout the course of the game to avoid delay of games, those are just the plays that are just shooting yourself right in the foot and are going to make it almost impossible to go on the road and win a big game, especially if you can't run the ball consistently. And really, for UConn, you couldn't do anything consistently on offense. It was just like a misjumbled sort of herky-jerk effort all the way through the game.
BYU won the first down battle 31-14, just to give you an idea, and then 539 total yards for BYU on the game, just 230 for UConn. So, you know, it gives you a sense of the tremendous production advantage that BYU had. And just, you know, if UConn's offense could have just been a little bit more productive, you know, we had seen bits and pieces of what has looked like a very competent offense at times so far this season. You know, they're definitely going to have to work on their consistency. The blocking is not there. Diaco said in the press conference today, I thought it was kind of interesting, that the running backs have been the biggest cause of stress in pass protection compared to the offensive line. In that they're the ones, you know, he didn't want to call anyone out specifically, but, you know, that they're the ones missing those blocking assignments, which, you know, I'm inclined to believe the running back group is young, and that's probably the reason Max DiLorenzo, you know, and has a role there on the team, is because he's a good pass blocker, a guy who can do all things. But, you know, credit to UConn for keeping it close for as long as they did. And then I think, you know, in terms of one bright spot, at least we had Arkell Newsom. But, you know, I think so far UConn has won the games that they're supposed to and lost the games that they, you know, that most people thought they would. So, you know, we'll just have to kind of see how the rest of the season plays out as we get into AAC play.
And even one more thing just quickly to mention is, as bad as the offense looked, certainly at times, there were opportunities in that game where Noel Thomas grabs that ball off his fingertips on a long play, and suddenly the entire game's different. You know, now you get a lead, now you're working with some momentum, and I think that there were just a couple plays that UConn left out there that really were just the type of plays you got to make if you're going to go out there and try to win a big game on the road.
Yeah, and you mentioned Newsom. I think that that was one of the interesting things for me today from Bob Diaco's press conference was him saying Ron Johnson is going to get back into a role where he's getting more carries and kind of sharing the load with Arkell. I don't necessarily buy that because Newsom has come out and he's been the guy running the ball for the last few games and he's done a great job. He's so versatile with his ability to run the ball, with his ability to play in the receiving game. Johnson's had one carry the last two games and it was for -3 yards. Overall, he still has more carries than Newsom does this year. I think it's like he has 11 more carries than Newsom, but Newsom's also averaging 4.9 yards per carry compared to his 2.3. He has the ability to really change direction quickly, see the slots or see the holes, see the gaps and get through them, whereas Johnson just kind of, I feel like he just runs straight until he can't anymore, and that's usually within a yard and a half.
Yeah, I mean, you have to imagine that's a little bit of gamesmanship from Diaco, probably not wanting to tip his hand, but absolutely right. I mean, Arkell, with how productive he's been and with the plays that he's been able to make and the authoritative way in which he's running the ball between the tackles, which I think may have been a reason why he didn't have a bona fide, you know, starting role at the start of the season. You know, you have to have a dynamic playmaker like that out on the field as much as possible, especially when you have an offense that can go anemic at times the way that it has. I think Johnson has a role, but you're right. He needs to be a little bit smarter of a runner in finding running lanes and stuff like that. But should be really, really exciting to see what Newsom does in the balance of this season.
And I think it's also it's impressive because he's so versatile. You know, he's able to run a bunch of wide receiver routes. We saw the wheel route. We know that they like to do that quick swing pass, which is almost like it's almost like a pitch play, but it is a quick pass. So I think that having him out there just forces the linebackers on the defense to just be a bit more passive and just wait for him to make his move because they're not sure if he's going to, like I said, if he's going to head out for a catch or if he's just going to pop a draw play for 20 yards. He gives you a lot of options when you have a versatile back like that.
Diaco did make a good point today about the running backs in the passing game and their inability to really protect on the pass rush. And I'm not really sure how you fix that. You got to have Newsom in the game to make those routes as a running back, but do you risk taking a wide receiver off the field and putting another running back back there, play with the two backs, like something like Max DiLorenzo, or you know maybe bring a tight end in back there, like someone like he's probably not going to play any, at all this year, but that Zoldan, who we've talked about before, you know he's probably not going to get his red shirt burned. But I don't know. I feel like there's few options in that regard. But with Newsom, you have to have him out there. You have to have him getting the carries, getting the catches. So it doesn't really seem like there's much of a fix to that.
Yeah, I mean, DiLorenzo has actually been pretty solid in the passing game in those few opportunities that he has had, but you're right. He's just, I mean, he can't be out there on every down, and well, you know, what do you do if your best playmaker also might not be the best pass blocker and you have to have someone out there at running back? You know, what do you do?
And that's something that can come with time as well, you know, experience, learning the protections, learning where the pressure is coming from and really what he needs to do to pick up those blitzes.
So, yeah, that's the BYU game, you know, tough loss against what was a really good team. Three straight losses for UConn, all against very, very good teams. So they've got UCF this weekend. UCF is winless, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But, Tim, let's talk about our favorite subject to talk
ice
about
bus?
On this podcast, the Ice Bus.
Let's talk Ice Bus.
Ladies and gentlemen, the UConn men's hockey team opened their season at Freitas Ice Forum on Saturday at 3 p.m. against the Canadian University Queens and came away with a 3-1 win. Tage Thompson, a freshman forward, put in the game-winning goal on a pretty nice play. But Tim, what were kind of your biggest takeaways from that preseason performance?
My takeaway was that Mike Kavanaugh definitely has options, but I think it was kind of funny with the preseason game. We were talking about this while we were watching it. You couldn't really draw too many assessments about who's going to be playing, who's going to be paired with who. It's just one of those things where you kind of just have to accept that you were watching a preseason game, and you have to wait until Friday with the Alabama-Huntsville game to find out what's really going to go down.
It's kind of remarkable that they really just have one preseason game. They had 1 week of practice before the preseason game.
They had a couple.
They did?
Okay. Yeah, they had, I think they started mid-September. Not mid-January.
Were they on the ice, though?
Yeah, for like, I think it's in total, you could have 3 or 4 hours a week. Something okay. like that. They were doing 40-minute practices.
So they had a light schedule up until last week, had about a week of intense practice, had their first exhibition game. They've got 1 week, and then they kick off the season this Friday in Alabama.
You know, you never want to take games for granted, but I think you could say that these are kind of like preparation games. These first three games, I should say. Alabama-Huntsville has perennially been, what's the way I can describe this?
An early season opponent.
Yeah.
A nice early season opponent.
I believe last year they finished closer to 50th than 59th in the pairwise rankings. And that was a miracle. There's 59 NCAA teams, and they're all ranked in the pairwise, which is kind of like the RPI. And Alabama-Huntsville is always right down there. So it's going to be interesting. Their barn is pretty cool. And the whole idea of an Alabama team like Huntsville playing in NCAA Division I hockey is pretty cool, so I wish I was going down. But I think UConn's going to have an easy time with this. Rob Nichols looks healthy, which is good. I love this freshman class. I think that the freshmen were some of the best performers on Saturday.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, with the way that they were just playing offensively and moving around and, you know, Letnov, I think the defensemen, just exactly as advertised, are great two-way players. Gendron and Misonius both able to bring it up really quickly and bring the puck into the zone and really just be all over the ice, it seemed like.
Tage Thompson is a monster. That guy's 6'4", and he's growing into his body. I think Letnov at 6'3" is going to do that eventually. He's still kind of a little skinny right now, but he's so quick. He's got incredible handles. He was attacking the net. And, you know, I think the other freshmen aren't going to get as much fanfare. Carl Elmir, Max Calter, guys like Marco Richter.
They were good, too.
Yeah, and you know, I really liked Marco Richter playing with Kasper Joentekinen and Corey Ronan, who just, they work so well together. That they were together with Spencer Nass last year for most of the year, and I talk about that line all the time. Dan and I talked about it last week. But I think Spencer played really well with Letnov, and oh my gosh, I can't remember who he played with. It doesn't matter. Joentekinen and Ronan play so well off of each other that you can put anyone else on that left wing and they'll be fine. And I thought Richter was really good. He was really explosive. There was the one play where right at the start of the game, it was their first shift, I believe. Joentekinen was struggling for the puck in the neutral zone, ends up poking it out to Ronan. And Ronan got through and had Richter kind of trailing him on a chance for a rebound early in the game. And so they looked lively. They looked like they knew how to skate with each other. So I think that's going to be a line to watch if Richter ends up staying with them.
So there you go, guys. Ice Bus, early projections. They look good.
And Nichols is healthy, which, as I already said, that's very important.
You need him.
Yeah, the puck was bouncing up on him, too, early on. It was a lot of weird shots coming at him. So the fact that he was able to move well and knock him down was important, I think. He didn't give up the goal. He made 7 great saves. Now, Steve Thule in the backup goalie kind of got caught out on the guy from Queens, Luongo, just came out of the box and no one was near him. So just on a clearance, he got the puck and happens. That's hockey.
Yep. So UConn men's hockey will open their season for real this Friday in Alabama. You can listen to that on WHUS, which is probably your best way to follow it, right, Tim?
Absolutely. Listen to Alex Geiner over there on WHUS. He does a great job. If you're looking for a lot of energy in the broadcast, he brings it, so that'll be a good time. It'll be like you're actually there.
And the UConn blog will be at the home opener next Friday, October 16th, against Arizona State.
And hopefully most games after that.
Absolutely. Home and away.
Yes.
We will now move on to talk a little bit about this weekend's highly, highly anticipated football game, the one we've been waiting for all summer. You've had it circled on your calendar since July. You will not be watching HGTV. You will change the channel and watch what we are now calling the Conflict. Capital FL, capital CT, Connecticut, one of the northernmost schools in the conference. UCF, one of the southernmost schools in the conference. They're winless, though. UCF is winless.
They're bad.
Diaco, when they first made it up and when he first kind of caught flack for it, he was saying, UCF, they're a great program. We want to emulate them. We want to be like them. They are 0-5. They have lost to Furman, FIU, and Tulane.
Yikes.
Was this Diaco being some sort of an evil genius? Getting in their heads early in the summer, like, UCF is the premier program. We want to target them. And then they're just like, oh, that's sweet. We are the best team. Boom, 0-5. Stanbeck's off the team. Holman's injured. Jordan Akins is done for the year. So what is going on?
George O'Leary is going to become your athletic director. I mean, yeah, I think there's a really good chance Diaco and his whole staff knew that this would be a down year for UCF, have everyone make fun of him all offseason. And in a year, what's the situation with UCF? We were talking earlier today.
Yep,
UCF,
they're young.
Really young team.
They have 26 new starters this year, which is the most in FBS. Kansas is second with 25, and then I believe number three has 18 or 19, something like that. So it is a significant difference between UCF and the rest of the nation. And, I mean, Kansas doesn't even really count as a football team. I shouldn't say that with UConn and basketball, whatever. They have 69 players on their team who have played so far this year, which is a significant amount. And 32 of them had never played a down for UCF before this year. So it's definitely rough. You know, like I said, Justin Holman's injured. Jordan Akins is injured. That's your quarterback and your best wide receiver. So you really don't have a lot to work with if you're UCF. And I just thought, as when we were talking about Diaco being the evil genius, that video unveiling of the new uniforms where he was kind of the mafia boss, I don't think that was acting. I'm now 99% convinced that Diaco is actually the Don.
Well, that's very possible. He is from New Jersey. He is Italian. So
that's all you need right there. That's all the evidence you need.
Don't rule anything out.
I know how this goes. My mom grew up on Federal Hill in Providence in an Italian family. This stuff is real. My mom is not in the mafia.
So UCF, you know, I mentioned FIU, I mentioned Furman as their losses. They're coming off a 45-31 defeat at the hands of the Tulane Green Wave.
Sherman Beatty getting me a fantasy touchdown.
I mean, Tulane is not supposed to be a very good team, and 45-31, that's a two-touchdown game. It was not actually that close of a game. This game was 38-10 at one point until UCF mounted a furious comeback. So, I mean, I don't think this will be too big of a challenge for UConn, but who knows?
I can't wait to see UConn against the run. You know, we talk about how good UConn is on run defense. UCF against Tulane had negative 35 net yards rushing, an average of negative 1.6 per carry. They got 392 yards through the air, but they were also intercepted 3 times, and they threw the ball 52 times. So that's bound to happen, especially when you're playing Tulane. But my goodness, I expected so much more from UCF, but maybe that's because I bought into the Diaco hype that they actually, or the quote-unquote hype, more of the messing with their heads that UCF was actually going to be decent this year.
And I think this is the perfect time for you kind of get UCF in the schedule. I mean, you still got the positive feeling. It's like we're seeing good things. We're kind of feeling good, even though we are losing these games. It's like our program kind of looks good. We're seeing things that we like to see, but yet we're still losing. This would be a nice time to get a win, get back in the win column, and reaffirm that all the things that we have been seeing, that we think we've been seeing, are actually happening and that we're making progress towards becoming a good team.
And it's not even like it's that bad with the situation that they're in at 2-3, because they did look really good against BYU. They looked really good against Missouri. And Navy, I just think a mistake here, a mistake there, hurt them on offense. But, you know, that was a great offense.
And they couldn't stop the triple option.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's 2-3, but it's not a bad 2-3 like it would have been a couple of years ago. I think that this is, like Brenner said, a great opportunity to get that win, especially since you have USF at home the next week. So now you have a chance to really quickly turn 2-3 into 4-3, which is going to be which is very important, because then you've got five games to get those two to become bowl eligible. Which, I mean, if this team goes bowl eligible this year, that's an unbelievable season to me. And I think that there's plenty of wins left on the schedule.
Yeah, I mean, even if they don't get to a bowl game, five wins would be a really impressive performance.
Yeah,
I remember
absolutely.
Our preseason podcast, you know, the most adventurous guy, I think, predicted four wins, and that might have been you, Tim.
That was me.
I think I, you know, preseason podcast, I think I went three, which, you know, I'm looking pretty silly right now, but from a very early point in this season, I think even with the Villanova game and even with the way the Army game went down, we were able to realize that this is a much better UConn team than we might think. And then they took Missouri to the wire. They played solidly against Navy and BYU, but you know, those are two really good teams. Those should be top 25 teams, I would imagine, by the end of this season. So making the trip to UCF, bringing the trophy, hopefully they bring it back. Bob has added both scores, guys, so don't worry about that.
That was nice of him.
He's added both scores to the trophy. He's definitely got a good attitude about it. I don't think there's any way to question that. And then, yeah, like Tim said, you got USF coming to town for homecoming the next weekend. That should be a winnable game. It'll probably be, you know, a final score of 5-0 or 5-3 or something like that.
I think you're going high there.
I might be. Take the under, especially if there's weather, but even if there's not. And then they've got East Carolina in a Friday night game, might be able to catch them. And then the next week they're at Tulane. So, you know, a good opportunity for UConn to maybe go 3-1 in their next four, or maybe even 4-0.
Yeah, and I know I said that there's a lot of wins left on the schedule, but you also have to remember this has been a great year for the American in the sense that, you know, most teams are, what, five games in, and you have four teams in the conference receiving votes, and Memphis sneaking into the coaches' poll. I only really go with the AP poll. I don't really trust the coaches' poll, but that's saying something. Memphis in there, and, you know, Navy and Houston. UConn still has Houston on the schedule. They still have Temple on the schedule. So it's going to be tough. I mean, they're lucky they avoid Memphis this year, so they, you know, that would be a very difficult game for them to win, in my opinion. But there's going to be a lot of competition, but it's competition that UConn can handle.
I was going to say, I mean, if you look at the games that Iman just mentioned, I mean, I don't see those teams going down to Missouri and playing them in a 9-6 game and having the defensive talent to be able to just stand up against SEC players and be able to play that type of game, whether you're talking about Tulane, South Florida, East Carolina. So I think that UConn really will have an advantage and should look to be favored in those games because they have, I mean, from what we've seen now, like you said, it's a far cry from the preseason where we had to be fair going off of what we saw last year. But from what we've seen at this point, there's some talent on this team that that can get you excited for the future.
And interestingly enough, UConn is a three-point underdog, or at least they opened as a three-point underdog. I think it might have moved down.
I think it's 2.5, but I think it's really that, you know, what's the old saying, the home team gets 3 points. So I think that, you know, I think that's just UCF getting the benefit of playing at home. And remember, they crushed UConn at home a few years ago, 62-17, which I believe I dubbed the headline in the Daily Campus, the Orlando Massacre. I don't think that's going to be the case this time around. I've been saying the last few games, I think UConn would lose to the teams they've been playing by a matter of a couple of points. I'm going to say they win this game by 10 or 13. I'm convinced of that.
I would have to agree with that, too. I don't see any that line, I don't see where they're getting it from. As you said, we're talking about a team that lost to Furman.
That's all you need right
there. Who is it that, I mean, who have they played well against that should give you confidence that they should actually be favored and giving away points in this game? I don't see that.
They sort of, kind of, not really, though, kept it close-ish against South Carolina early on. That's it.
Who's having, you know, an all-time bad season for them.
This is really uncharacteristic for them. And the only games they've kept close besides that are they lost by one to Florida International and Furman. you know, they had the 2-touchdown loss to Tulane, and they got blown out by Stanford. So, I mean, Stanford's a great team. You know, that's a game they should lose, but my gosh, the rest of it, 15-14 against FIU, 16-15 against Furman. You can't have that when you're UCF.
I'd like to see this team go into Missouri, see what the final score is going to be. You know what I'm saying? So I can't. That line seems crazy to me, and it seems like it's based off of last year and seeing how putrid UConn looked. And I think there might be an opportunity there, make a little money.
Yeah, there might be. And then you look at UCF's remaining schedule, it becomes AAC Murderers Row at Temple versus Houston at Cincinnati. This might be a winless UCF team heading into November, and that bar in Orlando,
I was just going to say that.
That is offering free beer.
I might, you know, I'm not going to go down for the game, but I might have to go down, stay with my best friend down there for a couple of days just to go enjoy the free beer that's going to be had. I'm looking at the schedule now, and like you said, UConn at Temple, Houston at Cincy, at Tulsa, East Carolina, USF.
Tulsa has been decent. East Carolina has been decent.
You're looking at a team that could go into that USF game November 26th on Thanksgiving with no wins. And honestly, if you put up USF against UCF right now, I'm taking USF. So we're looking at a team that cruises to potentially 0-12. What is the athletic director doing in that situation?
He's got to fire the head coach.
Does the athletic director George O'Leary fire head coach George O'Leary? This is a dilemma right now. I find it funny. He already, after that loss to Tulane, he only answered questions from one reporter. And it's funny because I feel like I saw something from a writer down there that was something along the lines of, you know, the athletic director should make the coach talk to the media. But that's sort of an issue right now with the athletic director being the head coach, who is having just a horrible year by his standards.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about that before the season. Like, how is that not the biggest conflict of interest in all of American collegiate sports? But, you know, whatever, they will persevere or they will not.
They won't.
Either way, we're bringing
free
a trophy. We're bringing a trophy down to Orlando. There's free beer at the bars, possibly all year while UCF is playing. And UConn is looking to come back with a trophy in the first ever Con Flicked game this Saturday, 3:45. Be sure to watch. And
I think after seeing Neil Ostrout tweet about this during the press conference, I think this game needs a theme song. But I don't really know what to do with a on the rise UConn team and a potentially heading toward winless UCF team. I mean, it's not really the most.
What's that thing where you take like something that someone says and make it into a sound, auto-tuning?
Yeah,
maybe we can auto-tune Mac and Cheese Guy.
Oh my god!
For Conflict Week, since I mean that guy got his Conflict Week off to a really rocking start,
yeah.
Because that was not very late in the night. It didn't seem.
It was like 6:30, 7 o'clock on a Sunday. So, dude, what are you doing walking into the Union with an open 40 on a Sunday?
That's going to do it for us here at the UConn Pod. For Brenner and Tim, thank you very much.